Hi, I'm Tricia Hunt from the Maine Humanities Council, and I'd like to welcome you to another in our series of podcasts exploring the power and pleasure of ideas in Maine.
Hannah Holmes of South Portland writes about science in a way that non-scientists can understand. When we spoke in 2006, she was working on a book about the human being, or more precisely, herself. Before that, she spent a year on her belly studying her backyard, inviting experts to help her understand its ecosystem. That book is called Suburban Safari. The idea for her first book, The Secret Life of Dust, hit her in the face one dry, windy day while she was in the Gobi Desert working on a magazine article.
It was so hideously dusty. It was horrible, and it was so windy that it got driven into pieces of your body you didn't know you had. I think there's probably some still in there. But I was standing out talking with the geologist one day, and you had to squint. I mean, camels have these really long eyelashes because it filters the dust from their eyes. Humans are not so equipped.
Who knew?
So having conversations, squinting and trying not to inhale. But the guys were explaining the reason the fossils are so perfect has to do with dust falling out of the sky and landing on these sand dunes in a certain way. And I said, where does the dust fall out of the sky from? And they said, well, stupid, you can't make a raindrop without a piece of dust for it to form upon. A lot of raindrops in this world.
Yeah.
A lot of dust particles. What on earth are they
made of?
And so I went home and started looking them up. And it was a fascinating journey.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a fascinating book. And it, again, like a lot of your work, it starts in this really arcane world of science. And it travels every now and then through that world. But just as often, it brings it down to earth so that there's a chapter that answers the question that we all want to know. I mean, can we get this dust out of our house? And what's the best way to do that? And also, as adults, are we somehow acclimated to this dust in terms of whether it's going to carry diseases? Because some of this dust is the dust of, like, you know, dried up fossilized pharaohs or something, right?
Yeah, if yeah. you're lucky.
So we're breathing them.
Oh, yeah.
We're breathing pharaohs.
Yes, but on the bright side, as my favorite dust scientist told me, the guy who did the Stardust satellite that recently came back to Earth with some comet dust, he said, space dust is always falling to Earth, it's in everybody's carpet, and you eat it. And if that horrifies you, bear in mind that it has diamonds in it.
Oh, I never thought of that. A diamond is forever then, isn't it? So from there, a funny thing happens. You've been traveling all the time, you do almost all of your writing in far-flung places. I think maybe 9/11 played a role in your deciding not to do that anymore.
What happened? I had when I was finished with Dust and ready for a new book project, I was looking at my wish list with my agent, and one of my fondest wishes was to go write about nomadic peoples of the earth. They're really endangered. People are trying to make them go to school and that kind of thing. But fascinating cultures that really are interlocked with a planetary system. And my agent said, and where would these people be located? And I said, well, sort of a lot of them are in North Africa. There's a fair amount of civil war there and some religious strife. And she said, it's just not going to sell.
Wow.
No one wants to be thinking about that after September 11th. And so this other idea that I'd always had in my back pocket about getting to know my part of the world better after having seen all the other parts of the world and knowing zip about mine.
You mean your yard?
My backyard, yeah, my home state, you know, the whole thing. It seemed like maybe the ideal time to spend a year at home, literally.
And you do this, and the result is called Suburban Safari. So you still approach it as if it were a faraway place, which is really what makes it so readable. And you befriend some creatures, but you also have a message in this book. It doesn't hit you hard over the head, but it reminds us that as a science writer, you do have some values, I think, that you want people to at least entertain, not necessarily shove down their throats, but consider. So talk to me a little bit about what you hope would happen after somebody like me with a suburban yard and maybe a couple cans of fertilizer and a lawnmower and cats. I know, you know I've got cats. What kind of behavior change would you like to see after a book like that coming into my hands or anybody else's?
I think the best that anybody can hope for, who is driven to educate the way I guess I am, the best we can hope for is to give people the facts and empower them to make decisions that they feel comfortable with. And I don't need to change everyone's behavior. I think everyone has a right to do what they need to do with their backyard. But I think it is important that people understand the implications of what they do. As humans, we've changed the planet sufficiently that it's now our project. It's no longer, the world is no longer a natural system. It is a human-created system entirely. And that has some burdens with it. There are some responsibilities attached. Once you push the system out of whack, then it's your responsibility to make sure it doesn't fall to pieces. There's a theory called bioregionalism that says the only way to do this is one backyard at a time, really. You need to know what's going on in your own back 40 to the extent that your human behavior can work for the most number of plants and animals possible.
That's kind of where this new book that you're working on now is moving. It's certainly a science book, but my guess is that it's got some other disciplines going on there. Can you talk about what that is, what you're working on?
The book I'm working on is A Field Guide to the Human Animal. When I went into my backyard for the Suburban Safari book, I went as though I had never seen an American backyard. I'd never seen a squirrel, never seen a seagull. What are these bizarre creatures? The thing I didn't have a chance to look at in that book was this animal.
The looker.
So now I'm taking that same approach. What is this animal all about? What does it eat? How big is it? What color is it? How does it mate and communicate? And it's so much fun.
I really do want to know how you think people can become more curious or allow children to become more curious. We have about 2 minutes, so my curiosity has to be satisfied quickly on that.
It's so easy, especially with children, to get that foothold in curiosity. And the wonderful thing about the work I did in my backyard was it illustrated so clearly to me, it takes a square foot to introduce not just a child, but any person to the miracles of nature. And I don't mean that in a religious sense. I mean, it's a place where you've walked 1,000 times, but if you sat there in a chair and looked at it, you would see things that would blow your head off right in your backyard. And it doesn't take too many experiences of stopping, investigating, and being impressed to build that impulse to look twice.
This podcast was brought to you by the Maine Humanities Council, with support from the National Endowment for the Humanities and friends like you. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.